The Syrian conflict is in its sixth year. Around 470,000 people have died, and ISIS has set up its de facto capital in Raqqa. In order to defeat ISIS in Syria, the U.S. has started arming Kurdish forces called the YPG. They're operating as part of the Syrian Democratic Forces, and since May, they've been getting ammunition, small arms, and vehicles from the U.S. That has infuriated Turkey, which sees the Syrian Kurds as an extension of a terror group that they've fought since the 1980s. Joining us now to talk about the ups and downs of arming the Kurds is Ranj Alaldin, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Doha. He's on Skype. And Nicholas Harris, a fellow in the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And let me start with you, Nicholas Harris. The U.S. supplied arms to the Syrian Kurds. You think that's a good idea. Why?
The U.S. has a narrowly focused mission, which is to conduct the counter-ISIS campaign. And in order to facilitate the capture of ISIS's capital of Raqqa, the U.S. military is determined that it has the ability to maintain a limited supply of armaments to particular units within the Kurdish majority People's Protection units, which is within the larger Syrian Democratic Forces coalition. And this is a focused mission. It's not about providing a blank check or an open inventory of weapons for Syrian Kurds. It is about empowering certain elements of the Syrian Democratic Forces coalition that will be in the beginning, in the tip of the spear of the campaign to conquer Raqqa.
Ranj, you say this could backfire spectacularly on the U.S.
Well, I think Nicholas said the word that I've been thinking of, which is narrowly focused mission. The problem here is not so much what the U.S. does. I think everybody agrees the YPG is the most effective Western-friendly force capable of confronting ISIS, capable of liberating Raqqa. The problem is what the U.S. Isn't doing, and that's adding a political component to its strategy, its engagement. You need to have an ally that is willing to engage with other actors, that is inclusive, that engages with the principles of good governance, of the rule of law, because if that does not happen, then that actor will become a liability in the future. There will be multiple conflicts, challenges, and problems to deal with once Raqqa is liberated.
Well, what about the issue that's come up time and time again when the U.S. arms a group to try to achieve its military goals, which is that some of the people that we arm end up fighting against us?
Well, I think with the Syrian Kurds in general, whether that's the YPG or the other multiple Kurdish actors, the U.S. will have no problems there, because historically the Kurds have generally been Western-friendly, Western-aligned actors. They've generally looked to the U.S. As a superpower that can give them that legitimacy. The YPG is a secular force at the same time as well. Its ideology isn't orientated around attacking the U.S. or attacking Western targets. So unlike, for example, some of the Islamist groups you have in Syria, the YPG certainly doesn't fit into that category of anti-Western, anti-American ideals.
Nicholas, do you agree that there's not a risk that by arming the YPG, that later on they'll end up using those weapons against U.S. interests?
I agree that the YPG is an unlikely force to turn its weapons against the United States. The U.S. has a real opportunity here to try to promote an authentically pluralistic governance in an area of Syria that has historically been repressed. There is a real need for the Trump administration to define what it wants to do with territory that's been conquered from ISIS, and how, if it wants to continue to maintain a residual U.S. force in eastern Syria, how it plans to prevent communal conflict in this area so that there can be a stable area of Syria, and you have a local security force that represents the various different communities that have raised their hands and said, yes, we want to fight with the U.S. against ISIS, and we look for a better future for Syria.
But some people may hear you say that and think, well, isn't that what we've kind of been trying to do in Iraq and Afghanistan? And it hasn't really worked out the way that people would have liked.
Well, the issue at hand is that the Obama administration made the decision in the end of 2014 that it wanted to conduct a counter-ISIS campaign via a quote-unquote light footprint approach, which means it minimizes the number of U.S. Soldiers on the ground in Syria. So it decided to go with to build up a local Syrian partner force, to make it a multi-ethnic force, and to support that force as it went and conquered territory from ISIS. Unfortunately, neither the Obama administration nor, it seems at this point, the Trump administration has really thought through what is the price of success for the U.S.-led coalition in Syria. In some respects, the U.S. could end up, by the end of the counter-ISIS campaign, over de facto control or influence over 40% of Syria's territory and a quarter of its population. And that presents numerous challenges for what is the phase four, or the post-ISIS governance consolidation security building phase. And I agree with the idea that if the U.S. is going to invest in these local Syrian partners, there may need to be a real detailed articulation from the Trump administration of how it plans to make sure that that area of Syria that is conquered from ISIS will be stable and will minimize conflict and will be able to provide for their people.
Ron Jalaluddin, what are your thoughts on the idea of whether you can really successfully outsource a fight to another group and have it work out for you in the end?
I mean, I don't blame any American or anybody else that points towards the blood on the treasure that has been spilt in places like Iraq. There's been billions of dollars invested in Iraq, in the state, and the country has very little to show for it. But I think in this particular case, ISIS did represent an imminent threat, not just to the region, but we've seen with the number of recent attacks that it is a transnational, international terrorist group that has the capacity to either direct or inspire attacks in America and so forth. So something had to be done, hence the triggering of the U.S.-led military campaign against ISIS. Now, in the case of the Kurds, you do have reliable actors that are capable of militarily defeating these groups. But as we saw in Iraq, what we really did there was contain the threat of terrorism. We never really eliminated the threat itself. We never really suppressed fully the space that allows these groups to thrive, to operate.
Well, let me ask you, Nicholas, about Turkey's objections to the U.S. arming the YPG. This is the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, after the U.S. made its announcement about arming them.
So our intent is to work with the Turks, with alongside one another, to take Raqqa down, and we are going to sort it out, and we'll figure out how we're going to do it, but we're all committed to it. We will work it out to our NATO allies and ours best way forward. War sometimes doesn't give you all good options. That's the nature of war.
Is it worth upsetting the Turks to this degree in order to arm the YPG?
Well, the Obama administration and the Trump administration have both made the calculation that the alliance with the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, of which the YPG is a part, is valuable for conducting the counter-ISIS campaign. If the U.S. objective in Syria is to defeat ISIS, however it defines that, and then to walk away, then you could see an expansion of the Turkish zone of influence that has been formed in northern Syria, which in and of itself would cause conflict with the local Kurdish community, which does not want to see expansion of the Turkish zone and also the placement of Turkish-backed militias in their areas. Or alternatively, if there is U.S. investment, and I agree that if there is U.S. investment in supporting good governance, in promoting local economies, in trying to create a genuinely pan-sectarian, pan-ethnic security force that is representative of the local communities over which the federal northern Syrian region is being built. That's the SDF-built region of Syria that's backed by the U.S. Then you may be able to mitigate over the long term potential conflict between Turkey and Syrian Kurdish areas. But it's a difficult challenge, and it's a dilemma.
Well, Ranj, let me just finally end with you and ask, how often does the U.S. or any other country that arms a group go back and get the arms when they're done with the conflict?
That's a very difficult question to answer. But I think for that, you would need to have a serious presence on the ground. We've seen historically that once you give armed groups, any armed group, whether it's the Kurds or the Arabs, Islamists, you name it, once you give them weapons, it becomes extremely difficult to take it back. Because, A, unless you have the mechanisms in place, you need to have the physical presence to physically get hold of the weapons.
Right.
But also, if the mechanisms aren't in place and agreed upon between the respective parties, you can't get those weapons back. Because, and by mechanism specifically, I mean what happens if the armed group doesn't give the weapons back? What happens in that case? Are there penalties? Are there repercussions? And the U.S. simply isn't in a position to demand of the YPG that it gives those weapons back. So I think that's probably posturing just to please the Turks and other opponents of the decision to arm the YPG.
That's Ranj Alaldin, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Doha. We've also been speaking with Nicholas Harris, a fellow in the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
Thank you.